He was a restless scientist with the explorer instinct of Auguste Mariette. And sure enough, in one of the lower-level baboon vaults, he uncovered a niche which led to another maze of underground passageways. One of the corridors was completely filled with ibis mummies in perfectly preserved ceramic vases. Thousands of these mummies were blocking the entrance. During excavations in 1970 to 71, Emery found corpses of birds of prey. It was impossible to count the numbers of eagles, falcons, vultures, ravens, and crows. Jean-Philippe Lauer, who saw the incredible network of underground vaults with his own eyes, estimates that their numbers went into the millions. As far as we know today, the Egyptians worshipped and mummified 38 different species of birds. Emery was certain that the subterranean passages were somehow related to the above-ground structures from the Third Dynasty, 2649 to 2575 BC. Fate, however, would not allow him to prove his theory. He suffered a stroke while doing the kind of work that fascinated him his whole life, excavating an archaeological site. Mummy rites and death magic. If we consider the effort involved in preparing millions and millions of animal mummies, we are bound to take a step back and think, sacred forms of life dedicated to the gods? That must have been it. Hindus, for example, still perceive the cow as a sacred animal, yet it has never occurred to them to embalm the dead animals with ointments, let them dry, wrap them in elaborate bandages, place them in monstrous sarcophaguses, and bury them in vaults tediously hammered out of rock. For the record, the Egyptians also considered the cow a sacred animal. Who borrowed this custom from whom? Along the Nile, people did not only mummify birds, baboons, and dogs. The vases also contained ibis eggs, 40 or even 100 at a time, each individually and carefully wrapped in cloth. More than 200,000 mummified crocodiles were buried in the Tebtinus Necropolis, an underground cemetery west of the Nile near the oasis Fayum. Archaeologists found clay urns containing meticulously wrapped crocodile eggs, scattered among the decomposed crocodile corpses, partly eaten by insects. Ancient texts, such as those of Herodotus and others, describe a gigantic maze of sacred crocodile remains, the Souchion. To this day, the location of the Souchion has remained a mystery. The old Egyptians did not even spare snakes and frogs from mummification. Various types of venomous snakes, which were abundant in Egypt at the time, were anointed with sweet-smelling potions, wrapped in narrow linen bandages and placed in long wooden sarcophaguses. Mummified frogs, all wrapped up in cloth, were jammed into small bronze containers. Not to be left out, the priests of Esna, a town about 50 kilometers from modern-day Luxor, specialized in the mummification of fish. Thousands of fish, from the smallest to the biggest, all carefully wrapped, were found in a fish necropolis 10 kilometers west of Esna. From a modern point of view, this whole mummy business can only be interpreted as a religiously motivated ritual on the part of the Egyptians. They venerated their animals and believed that even the poor beasts had a ka, and that they would need their earthly bodies in the afterlife. Economically, the whole custom was foolish. Sarcophaguses and vaults were filled with tremendous amounts of valuables and precious metals. The elaborate mummification of all these animals required an incredible amount of labor. What for? To preserve dried corpses? The Egyptians knew, with the benefit of 1,000 years of experience and from their everyday observation, that these mummies were not going anywhere. None of the empty bandaged shells magically returned to life. No dead crocodiles tunneled themselves out of their burial cloths, and never did the barking of resurrected dogs interrupt the dreary silence of a necropolis. There is absolutely no doubt that the Egyptians practiced their animal worship in prehistoric times. It was not a custom introduced by the pharaoh's priests. What belief or misbelief was so powerful that it was able to endure in Egypt for thousands of years? Even ancient authors pondered the question. Diodorus Siculus writes, "Everything the Egyptians do in their veneration of the sacred animals is strange and unbelievable, and this presents great difficulties to anyone investigating its causes. Their priests hold certain secret doctrines concerning these matters, which we explained earlier in our discussion of their gods. But most of the Egyptians allege one of the following three explanations, the first of which is wholly fabulous and quite in keeping with old-fashioned simplicity of beliefs. For they say that the first gods who existed were few in number and oppressed by the multitudes and by the lawlessness of earth-born men, but that they escaped this savagery and cruelty by adopting the forms of various animals. Later, however, when they had come to be masters of the universe, they showed their gratitude to the agents of their earlier deliverance by sanctifying those species of animals which they had imitated, teaching men how to care luxuriously for the living and perform funeral rites for the dead. The second reason they offer is that the Egyptians of old, through lack of discipline in their army, were defeated in many battles by the neighboring peoples, until they conceived the idea of carrying ensigns before the divisions of their host. Therefore, they continue, the leaders fashioned images of the animals which they have now come to worship, and bore them elevated upon javelins. And in this way, every soldier was able to recognize his own unit in the line of battle. The third explanation they put forth concerning this question is the service that each of the animals provides for the benefit of mankind and the life of the community. Diodorus Siculus emphasizes repeatedly that this is the interpretation given by the people. The priest's knowledge of the origins of animal worship had to be kept secret, even back then. Lucian, around A.D. 120, a Greek author who in his old age became imperial secretary in Egypt, writes that the Egyptian animal cult is based on astrology. He maintains that the people in different districts of Egypt worship different signs in the sky, and that they transferred these signs onto their local animals. However, other ancient writers dispute this claim. They assert that the animals were venerated out of fear and terror, or because they performed miracles. Diodorus Siculus reports one such instance, the story of a king named Menes, who was chased into Lake Moeris by his own dogs and was saved by a crocodile, which carried him to the other side of the lake. We are tempted to dismiss such stories as legends and fairy tales born of overactive imaginations. But could they contain a grain of truth? Could it be some misinterpreted basic truth whose real meaning is known only to priests and insiders? Dr. Theodor Hopfner, an expert who studied the animal cults of ancient Egypt 70 years ago and who was familiar with all the relevant old texts, concluded that none of the available facts would explain why the Egyptians should have assumed that their gods would be incarnated in animals. Neither did Hopfner believe that the animal cults were based on the superstition that the souls of deceased humans would be incarnated in animals. He saw no signs to indicate that the Egyptians believed in a transmigration of the soul. Now what? Here is an interesting fact. Only certain animals within a given species were considered sacred. The priests did not place the holy zeal on just any gazelle, dog, cow, or bull. They only chose those with unmistakable characteristics. Herodotus describes the black and white Apis bull as having the following marks. He is black, with a square spot of white upon his forehead, and on his back the figure of an eagle. The hairs in his tail are double, and there is a beetle upon his tongue. Only this particular bull was worshipped in prehistoric Egypt. The old Egyptians perceived the sacred bull as a representative of the cosmos, a creation of the god Ptah. This very ancient cult worship is evidenced by the amulets of star-crowned bull's heads found near Abydos, or by the golden sun disks which were placed between the horns of the Apis bulls. Plutarch, a Greek historian and philosopher, around AD 50, wrote that the sacred bull was not born in a natural way. It arrived with a moonbeam falling out of the sky. This theory is supported by a stele which Auguste Mariette discovered in the Serapeum. The inscription above the Apis bull states, "You do not have a father. You have been created by the sky." According to Herodotus, the Egyptians say that fire comes down from heaven upon the cow, which thereupon conceives Apis. At some unknown prehistoric point, the mysterious gods played a game with Apis and other animals, but it was at a time which we are unable to comprehend historically. Thus, the seeds of this animal cult were sown in mythical times, nurtured by the contradictory actions of the gods, which no human being could understand. These gods of supernatural origins performed impossible feats, deeds that simple humans were unable to grasp. They brought animals to life. Who else can do that? They lived in animals and acted through animals. Animals provided the gods with information about mankind. They supported the gods in their struggles against man and against each other. Similarly divine is the creation of new animals, the coupling of species that did not interact naturally. All the hybrids, the monsters, and various sphinxes are divine creations. All of this was a little too much for the limited comprehension of simple people who had barely emerged from the Stone Age. Even the most creative and most daring human imagination needs a stimulus to work from. Nothing comes out of nothing, not even imaginary creations. Animals on the Drawing Board. In my last book, I voiced a concern that has grown since then, and it is directly related to the animal cults of ancient civilizations. I was discussing the developments and further possibilities of gene technology. I pointed out that geneticists would soon be able to create new life forms and to combine existing ones. I wrote that development can be truly amazing and unexpected, and that it proves that changes in reality in some instances can outstrip the boldest speculation. In April 1987, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office announced that in the future it would grant patents for multicellular living organisms if they are based on a program which does not occur in nature. Thus, the office legalized a development that had long been a reality. Up until March of 1987, more than 200 genetically altered microbes had been submitted for patent rights. Microbes which might neutralize oil spills or produce insulin, for example. In April 1987, 15 patent applications were submitted for animals which did not exist in nature. Scientists at the University of California, for instance, succeeded in biotechnologically crossing a sheep with a goat. This new laboratory-generated creature had the front of a sheep and the rear of a goat. Horrified critics were supposed to be appeased by the assurance that this monster was only the prototype of a series and that the designers promised to improve future models. I asked my readers, in the face of such evidence, who would dare deny the possibility that flying horses may have existed? Flying mice, bats, and flying fish have been a reality for thousands of years. I believe the question is justified whether such creatures are the products of natural evolution or the laboratory creations of alien visitors. That was the state of affairs when I wrote in 1987. Since then, the clock has been ticking away. In 1976, Genentech Corporation was founded in California. Its goal was to study the application of genetically developed drugs and to market them commercially. In its first years, the company had nothing but expenses for investments and wages. Nobody was really sure it would succeed. Nowadays, its annual gross revenue exceeds $250 million. Genentech has been highly profitable for years, and its success has spawned a crop of about 300 similar enterprises worldwide. What do they make? What perverted new outlet has capitalism found? In 1979, Genentech was able to duplicate the human insulin gene. A year later, it developed a process to produce interferon alpha. Shortly after that, Genentech created the genetically engineered drug Protropine, a hormone which corrects growth problems in children. Licenses are issued for such products. Licenses bring money. In the near future, Genentech expects to receive a patent for a drug which will perform miracles in the healing of wounds. We are imitating the gods of ancient mythology. Open wounds are magically healed overnight. On June 13, 1988, the German daily Die Welt reported that one of the most ambitious projects of molecular science, the complete decoding of the human genetic makeup, is taking on concrete forms. The Genome Project, which has been hotly debated for over 2 years by scientists, is expected to cost $3 billion. According to Die Welt, scientists are determined to analyze the entire human genetic material down to its smallest component within the next few years, at a tremendous cost in terms of personnel, equipment, and money. They will succeed. Genetically engineered humans are not too far off. The Genome Project is not aimed solely at humans, but is expected to include other organisms as well. After all, we are all related in some way, aren't we? Geneticists at the University of Texas have developed a process which allows them to immediately distinguish genetically manipulated animals from the true or original animals. The process is very simple. The genetically manipulated genes are combined with an extra gene which triggers luciferase. That is the enzyme responsible for the cold light produced by lightning bugs. The enzyme is handed down to the following generations. All the descendants inherit the luciferase gene. A small tissue sample will be taken to determine whether an animal several generations down the line is descended from a genetically altered specimen. When treated with certain chemicals, the sample will start to glow. I had always wondered how the mythological gods were able to distinguish certain creatures instantaneously from others of the same species. But the mystery is starting to unravel. Dr. Tony Flint, director of the London Zoo, recently created an animal bank. Not for investments or financial trading, mind you. The animal bank collects eggs, sperm, embryos, and genetic material from animal species which are threatened with extinction. In this way, it is argued, geneticists of the future will have a chance to resurrect these species. Divine ambitions, indeed. Manetho and Eusebius, two witnesses. Is it really too far-fetched, too speculative, to apply our immediate future to our mystical past? Are the two completely unrelated, as some people suggest? Or could the very distinctive Apis bull have been the result of genetic manipulation? I would like to call to the stand two witnesses who are several thousand years older than me. One of them is named Manetho. He was a high priest and scribe for the holy temples in Egypt. In the works of the Greek historian Plutarch, Manetho is mentioned as a contemporary of the first king Ptolemy, 304 to 282 BC. Plutarch reports that the king ordered a heavy sculpture moved to Alexandria, and that Manetho was the only person who was able to inform the king that the mysterious sculpted creature was a Serapis. Manetho was an inhabitant of Sebennytus, a city located in the Nile Delta, and that is where he wrote his 3-volume book about the history of Egypt. He was an eyewitness to the fall of the 3,000-year-old emperor of the pharaohs. As a scholar, he composed a chronicle about his gods and his kings. Manetho's original text has been lost, but essential passages from his work were adopted by the Greek historian Julius Africanus, who died in AD 240. The second witness whose testimony I want to submit is also a historian. His name was Eusebius. He died in A.D. 339. He was bishop of Caesarea and one of the early Christian chroniclers. Eusebius relies heavily on Manetho, but includes many other sources as well. He indicates in the foreword to his chronological tables that he perused the manifold texts of such ancient writers as the Chaldeans, Assyrians, and Egyptians. Manetho and Eusebius often complement each other, although Eusebius tends to present the Christian interpretation, while Manetho sticks to facts, numbers, and names. Manetho's account begins with a listing of gods and demigods and the times of their respective reigns. The dates are too much for our archaeologists to comprehend. According to Manetho, the gods ruled Egypt for 13,900 years, followed by 11,000 years during which demigods ruled the country. I will discuss this in detail later on. Manetho writes that the gods created a number of creatures, monsters, and all kinds of hybrids. Eusebius endorses this belief. And there were certain other creatures, some of whom had created themselves and were equipped with reproductive organs. And they created humans with two wings, and others with four wings, and two faces, and one body, and two heads, men and women, and two genders, male and female. Furthermore, other humans with the thighs of goats and horns on their heads, and still others with the hooves of horses, and others with the body and legs of horses and the trunk and heads of humans, who resembled the hippocentaurs. Moreover, they created bulls with human heads and dogs with four bodies, whose tails emerged from their hindquarters like fish tails. Also horses with the heads of dogs, and humans and other monsters with horses' heads and human bodies and fish tails. Furthermore, all kinds of dragon-like monsters, and fishes and reptiles and snakes, and a large number of wondrous creatures in various shapes, all different from one another, whose images they kept in the temple of Belos, one next to the other. Hybrids abound. That's some strong medicine this Eusebius wants us to swallow. One has to read his account two or three times slowly to register fully the preposterousness of his words. How was it back then? There were humans with two wings? Is all this nonsense? If it is, why do we meet these creatures in hundreds of statues and sculptures displayed in all the major museums? They are not called double-winged humans, but rather, with the total lack of imagination so common on modern archaeology, winged geniuses. Humans with goat thighs and horns on their heads? Are they really nothing but imaginary creatures? How about a look at some Sumerian and Assyrian seals and temple walls? There are hundreds of depictions of such mixed breeds. Similarly, we find a number of horse-hoofed humans and centaurs, half-human, half-horse, in ancient drawings. And the gods also created bulls with human heads. Remember the sacred Apis bull? The Louvre exhibits three small figurines, each about 10 centimeters high, of bulls with human heads. They have been dated to 2200 BC. Let us not forget the monster of Crete, the Minotaur, a bull with a human head for whom the people of Crete built the famous maze. Eusebius talks about dogs with fish tails, other monsters, and a large number of wondrous creatures. And what about the Sphinx? When we talk about the Sphinx, everybody thinks of a huge statue of a human-faced lion next to the Great Pyramid of Giza. However, sphinxes come in all shapes and sizes. There are lion bodies with ram heads, dog or goat bodies with human heads, ram bodies with bird heads, human bodies with crocodile heads, and so forth. Entire zoos of different sphinxes have been dug from the desert sands or identified on Egyptian temple walls. Particularly strange creatures were discovered on a wall of a small side temple in Dendura in central Egypt. They combined the long-maned heads of lions or baboons with slender, almost human torsos and snake tails. These curious hybrids, dedicated to the goddess Hathor, rest elegantly on their curled-up tails. Wondrous creatures, Eusebius calls them, in various shapes, all different from one another. Anybody who has taken the time to stroll through any large museum or to peruse a photographic book about Sumer, Assyria, or Egypt can confirm the abundance of such wondrous creatures. The Museum of Baghdad features the statue of the archaic goddess, a woman's torso with delicate breasts and the head of a monster. A museum in Berlin displays the replica of the Ishtar temple gate in Babylonia. Scaly creatures with long tails and unusually long necks are paraded on a blue, yellow, and brown enameled tile wall. Their front legs feature lion paws, while their hind legs are equipped with the sharp talons of eagles. The original is said to date back to 600 BC. A Sumerian seal displayed at the Louvre in Paris and a tablet at the Egyptian Antiquities Museum in Cairo both show four-legged creatures with long, curved necks topped by snake heads. Natural evolution never created such absurd hybrids. Are they merely an example of artistic liberty? Why are these beasts kept on a short leash by attending humans? Also at the Louvre, we can admire the 23-centimeter cup of Gudea, which originates around 2200 BC. The engraving on the cup shows a very unusual kind of hybrid, with bird claws on its legs, the body of a snake, human hands, wings, and the head of a dragon. Eusebius, furthermore, all kinds of dragon-like monsters. A 20-centimeter statue depicts a winged goddess with a graceful female torso, a girlish face, a woman's hands, in short, a perfect lady. The picture-perfect pinup loses much of its appeal, however, when we catch sight of the wings on her back and the repulsive animal claws on her feet. There is certainly no shortage of artistic expressions of such wondrous creatures. Hybrids and monsters abound at the Asutosh Museum in Calcutta, the Archaeological Museum of Ankara, the Museum of Delphi in Greece, as well as the Metropolitan Museum in New York, to name but a few. A relief dedicated to the Assyrian king Assurbanipal, on view at the British Museum, shows a husky man leading a strange animal by a rope. It walks like a monkey on 2 feet, but its hands end in fins. The British Museum also owns a black obelisk made for the Assyrian king Salamazar II. Among other things, it depicts an elephant followed by two small creatures the size of children. They have human heads combined with the bodies, thighs, and legs of animals, and are kept on a leash by two guards. A different section of the same obelisk portrays two sphinx-like creatures with undeniably human heads. Nothing unusual, you say? Why does one of the sphinxes suck its thumb? Why are they chained up? Why does the text accompanying the pictures describe them as human animals being led into captivity? Even in the distant South and Central America, artists have immortalized hybrid creatures in their own works. The Olmec, Mayan, and Aztec cultures feature numerous examples of human-animal monsters on temple walls and codices, always in connection with imperious gods. 18 years ago, I had the opportunity to photograph a number of metal tablets with indefinable creatures that were part of a collection belonging to Father Crespi of Cuenca, Ecuador. Father Crespi, who is now deceased, claimed to have received the tablets from local Indians. They are made from the Inca alloy of gold, copper, and zinc. In the summer of 1988, archaeologists made a most spectacular discovery near the small town of Sipan in northern Peru. They found the perfectly preserved tomb of a Mochi priest and nobleman. The culture of the Mochi Indians was thriving along the Peruvian coast around the birth of Christ. The nobleman had been buried in a wooden sarcophagus, accompanied by a large amount of jewelry, pearls, pottery, and gold, and was about 35 at the time of his death. The same family tomb contained four additional sarcophaguses with women and men. Several meters above the actual sepulchre, archaeologists encountered the skeleton of a man wrapped in cotton sheets. It was accompanied by a copper scepter, about 1 meter long, with a very explicit picture of a woman having sexual intercourse with a hybrid monster, half tomcat, half reptile. In addition to these unequivocal visual reproductions, there are certainly a large number of hybrid creatures that no man or woman has ever seen. Many cultures describe the imaginary transformation of one monster into another. The image of a centaur, for example, may have resulted from the shadowy perception of a horse and its rider as being one. Similarly, the image of Pegasus may be rooted in wishful thinking, the human desire to own a winged horse. In the Adventures of Ulysses, the great Greek poet Homer, around 800 BC, mentions the sirens, who sing such a beautiful melody that the sailors forget their mission. Homer himself did not describe the sirens in any physical detail, but later writers turned them into winged women with birds' feet. Sirens have been a favorite subject of artists throughout the ages, although no artist ever laid eyes on one. The German legend of the Lorelei derives directly from the ancient sirens. Hybrid creatures abound not only in the dramatic literature of ancient times, but also in more modern children's fairy tales. Around 700 BC, the Greek writer Hesiod portrayed the monster Medusa, whose head sprouted a number of snakes, as being so terrible to behold that people would turn into stone upon seeing it. In his Walpurgis Night, the German dramatist Johann Wolfgang von Goethe imagines Adam's seductress as a snake with a woman's head. Elliot Smith sees the Chinese dragon as a hybrid between snake, crocodile, lion, and eagle. This and much more may grow from the multifaceted spectrum of human imagination, without which there would be no fairy tales. I have to look beyond that. I am searching for a common denominator, the original key that opened the door for all these images to enter our thoughts and perceptions. After all, these wondrous creatures occur not only in the works of old Manetho and the theologian Eusebius, but also in Plutarch, Strabo, Plato, Tacitus, Diodorus Siculus, and Herodotus, although the latter is reluctant, as he states on several occasions, to describe such monsters. Logically, there are only two possible ways to explain the stories and artistic representations of these hybrid creatures. One, they never existed. They are, without exception, the product of someone's imagination. In that case, the painters, sculptors, and writers must have exaggerated wildly. Two, such hybrid creatures did in fact exist at some point. If that is the case, the wondrous creatures of Eusebius could only have evolved through genetic design. Any other conclusion is impossible, because natural evolution cannot produce such hybrid monsters. The reproductive organs and chromosomes of the animals involved are too different. Sexual interaction would not produce any offspring. Does this make sense? I cannot walk through a rain shower without getting wet. In dealing with these wondrous creatures, I walked through some heavy showers and got wet to the bone. But my thoughts remained firmly grounded in reality. I admit that the idea that these monsters, as they are described by Eusebius and others, in various shapes, all different from one another, could actually have lived seems far-fetched at first. Our minds, so comfortably accustomed to the cuddly creatures we find in nature, refuse to consider a zoo of living monsters. I will be accused of trying to make reality conform to my own wishful thinking. And I will consider myself in good company, looking at the ancient writers. Is the very idea that wondrous creatures may have existed proof that they could not have existed? Are stories wrong just because they are legends? Who turned the ancient stories into legends? Could it have been our limited understanding? Could it have been the narrow and inflexible horizon of academic rationale that dictates to our generation how far its thinking may go? I suspect that much of what we dismiss as unrealistic and irrational was once living history. The Roman philosopher Lucius Appuleius, who lived in the 2nd century AD and who traveled in Egypt, wrote in the Metamorphoses, "O Egypt, Egypt! Your knowledge will survive but in legends, which later generations will be unable to believe." The following fable from the eternally young genre of science fiction could shed some light on our problem here. A science fiction model. There was once a time when the gods ruled the earth. Man did not know who the gods were or where they had come from. Barely evolved past the animal stage, humans passively waited for the light. The gods lived in the sky, somewhere up there among the stars. There, among the asteroids between Jupiter and Mars, aliens had anchored their mothership. The long spaceflight between the stars had used up most of their energy supply. It was time for a pit stop to secure further resources and perform the necessary maintenance. Thus, the gods were forced to spend a couple of centuries in our solar system. The years passed slowly. The gods got bored quickly. In search of variety and entertainment, they devised games and contests. They had no concept of human mortality or ethics in today's sense of the word. Their feeling and thinking came from a different dimension. Earth was their playground. One day, Ptah, divine designer of organs, created a new creature on his drawing board. The genetic material came from two stupid life forms on Earth. The ensuing combination between a lion and a sheep spawned a new vegetarian creature with the paws and the speed of a lion. But Ptah was shocked to discover that a real lion had no trouble tearing the divine creature to shreds. That was certainly unacceptable. Kanum said to Ptah, "The brain of the sheep was inferior to that of the lion. Try a different combination, with a lion torso and a bull's head." This monster survived because the lions of the world avoided it. Ptah was ready to celebrate his new creation when something incredible happened. The primitive two-legged creatures on Earth banded together and killed the monster with their spears and slingshots. Like lightning, Ptah descended on mankind, angrily punishing the clumsy humans who did not understand his design. The council of the gods reprimanded Ptah for his actions. "It is wrong," they said, "to punish people for their behavior if they have not been warned in advance of the negative consequences." Ptah agreed and began to mark all of his new creations with a visible sign, a light-colored rectangle on the forehead, for instance, or two shining horns on the temple. Now the humans knew which creatures were the gods' property and which they were allowed to kill for food. The extraterrestrials had found a way to keep themselves busy. They merrily invited one monster after another, in various shapes, all different from one another. They studied the behavior in their creations, their usefulness, their interaction in a natural environment, and they observed with much amusement the reactions of the flabbergasted humans. Finally, the mothership was replenished with the necessary resources. It was time to explore some new territories of the universe. The gods left behind a subdued human race with all the animals that had populated the earth since the beginning, plus the divinely created monsters. The priests were the first to realize that the gods had vanished. Scared and unsure, they did not dare to lay a hand on the gods' new creations. Generations came and went. Many of the divine beasts died and became extinct. But others, those with life-producing forms, Eusebius, mutated, were taken captive, or were pampered in the temples. The priests kept the knowledge alive of certain creatures dedicated to the gods. And because the priests feared that the gods could return at any given moment without notice, they watched the sky apprehensively for any unusual movement. Novices were commissioned to search the land for the gods' sacred animals and to bring them to the temples so that they could be properly worshipped. It was obvious to the priests that the sacred animals, if they died, had to be mummified and buried in splendor. After all, they belonged to the gods, whose return might be imminent. Centuries passed, even millennia. Times changed, and so did people. In folk tales, the memory of terrible monsters lived on. Nobody was afraid of the small creatures like birds, fish, or pets. People were able to talk to them, maybe use them to intercede with the gods on their behalf. But what about the large, fearsome beasts? Would they be changed back into their horrible original form after death? Would they frighten and terrorize people if they were to be reborn? What could man do to satisfy the gods without suffering under these beasts? The priests pondered this momentous question for a very long time. Finally, they found a simple solution. As long as they were alive, the animals were to be pampered, worshipped, idolized, so that their ka and ba would ascend to the gods after their death, where they would be able to attest to the benevolence and respect with which mankind had treated them. The bones of the animals, however, were to be fractured, smashed into pieces, and mixed with asphalt after their death. Their remains were to be placed in heavy sarcophaguses made from the hardest granite, coffins so massive and huge that no monster, if it happened to be reborn, would be able to escape from them. The sarcophaguses had to be anchored deep in an underground vault. These monsters should never be able to attack and tyrannize people again. Pseudo-animals in the wrong vaults. We need models, new ideas, to make even marginal sense of the absurdities and contradictions that our ancestors left us with. The story I invented here cannot be considered anything more than such a model, or a crutch, if you prefer, to help us hobble out of the swamp of our own past. We are more than willing to accept and appreciate the writings of Herodotus, Strabo, Diodorus Siculus, Tacitus, Manetho, or Eusebius, if they fit our common pattern of knowledge, but heaven forbid that they not fit. Arrogantly, we elect ourselves judge and jury and categorically dismiss the same writings of the very same authors. Even if it is obviously the truth, it cannot be. What did Auguste Mariette find on September 5, 1852, in the undamaged bull sarcophaguses of Saqqara? As he reported, his first concern was for the head of the bull, but he found none. The sarcophaguses contained a foul-smelling, bituminous mass which disintegrated under the slightest pressure. Were the bones of this pseudo-animal smashed many years or centuries after the actual burial? Not according to Mariette. He said that the stinky mass was permeated with a large number of tiny bones which apparently had been fractured at the time of burial. And what about the second intact sarcophagus? According to Mariette, there were no skulls of bulls, no large bones. On the contrary, he found an even greater supply of tiny bone fragments. Why did the archaeologist Sir Robert Mond find bones in bull sarcophaguses which he assumed were those of jackals or dogs? I do not blame an anthropologist for not examining such bones any further. Why should it occur to him or her that there may have been dogs with four bodies whose tails issued from their backs in the manner of fish tails? Eusebius. Dr. Eng Pierre Leca is a physician and specialist in Egyptian mummies, and is the author of an exciting book on the subject. In it, he mentions two wonderfully bandaged bulls with a beautiful outside, which were found in the vaults of Abu Sir. Inside the second mummy, which appeared to be a single bull, Leca found the bones of seven animals, among them a two-year-old calf and a huge old bull. A third looked as if it had two skulls. I beg your pardon? Two skulls? Just ask Eusebius, who described wondrous creatures in various shapes, all different from one another, with one body and two heads. Naturally, I informed Dr. Halil Ghali, the chief excavator of Saqqara, of my suspicions. I asked him if he or any of his colleagues had ever found mummies of animals whose bones did not seem to go together at all. He stared at me pensively, a little incredulously, I thought. My God, who would pay attention to something like that, is what I imagined him saying to himself. No one. The very thought is absurd. The zealous excavator, Walter Emery, discovered catacombs of sacred cows in Saqqara. There was no doubt about their purpose, because the inscriptions on the carefully hewn limestone blocks read, "Here rests Isis, mother of Apis." Moreover, the excavators found several well-preserved papyri from the 3rd and 4th centuries B.C., which invoke and praise the cow goddess. But instead of a cow mummy, the archaeologists encountered a bundle of wrapped bones from calves and other animals. Jean-Philippe Lauer, Emery's successor, identified the bones, beyond a doubt, as being from plundered graves. Yet he could not find an entrance to any such graves. As I mentioned before, grave robbers are interested in objects of economic value. They mess up and destroy the graves. They are not academicians or pranksters. It is difficult to imagine why grave robbers would have transferred bones from a different tomb into the vaults of the sacred cows. The Mystery of the Baby Baboon. A baboon with the head of a dog lived in ancient Egypt and Nubia, now Sudan. The Egyptians considered it sacred. This baboon was even part of the tribute which the Egyptians exacted from the Nubians. Thousands of these funny-looking creatures, with the jaws of a dog and a thick mane, were mummified. Nobody has ever thought much about it. After all, similar baboons exist today. But there is one curious discovery that deserves some further scientific study. In 1972, Dr. Henry Riad, then director of the Egyptian Antiquities Museum in Cairo, granted permission to several scientists to X-ray and examine mummies. Professor James E. Harris from the University of Michigan studied the mummy of the priestess Makare. She held the highest title in the female hierarchy, as wife to the god Amun. The way she was bandaged indicates she died in childbirth, because the body of the baby, also wrapped in bandages, was placed on the mother's body in the sarcophagus. The tiny bundle was X-rayed from all angles, and the scientists were speechless. What had been thought to be a baby turned out to be a dog-headed baboon with a slightly enlarged brain volume. I believe it is justifiable to ask whether this woman, priestess to the god Amun, gave birth to the little monster. Herodotus makes no secret of his disapproval regarding the sexual perversion of the Egyptian priests. He maintains that the Egyptian painters and sculptors depict the god Pan with the head and the legs of a goat. They represent him thus for a reason which I prefer not to relate. But a few lines later he remarks angrily that a he-goat had intercourse with a woman publicly. Apparently, Diodorus Siculus also knew more than he let on when he wrote that the origins of animal worship had to be kept secret. A few Egyptologists I know are open-minded people who have contributed greatly to the solution and reconstruction of the ancient Egyptian mysteries. Egyptology has a unique position within the field of archaeology. Egypt is the only place where scores of temples and sculptures have been reclaimed from the desert sands over the past decades, thanks to the tenacity and infinite diligence of Egyptologists. As hieroglyphs have been deciphered, the history of ancient Egypt has become more transparent. Egyptologists know what they're talking about. They will excuse me of hiding the fact that some genuine mummified Apis bulls were found as well. They can be admired at the Louvre or the Museum of Natural History in Vienna, Munich, and New York. I am well aware of their existence, but I am also aware of the fact that their origins and contents are highly obscure. Anybody who has studied this topic at length knows that the priest Manetho, of all people, was a staunch supporter of the Serapis cult, and that real bulls undoubtedly were buried during his lifetime. We also know of the texts honoring Apis that were found in the Serapium of Alexandria and in other places. But all of this dates back to the Ptolemies and the Romans, a mere 2,000 or 2,500 years before our time. I am not aiming at this recent era. I am aiming at the origins of the animal cults, which go back into ancient history. Isn't it odd that the first pharaoh Ptolemy, 304 to 284 BC, has a heavy sculpture hauled back to Alexandria, which has been lying around in the dirt, and no one knows what the sculpture represents? The priest Manetho, who happens to be nearby, is the only one who can enlighten his king on the subject. He announces that the mysterious feature is a Serapis. Serapis is the Greek word for the sacred bull. This brief anecdote, related by Plutarch, leads to an ominous conclusion. The king and his entourage were all stupid. They did not even recognize the sculpture of a bull. I wonder why not. Probably because the sculpture showed one of the wondrous creatures. Only a priest like Manetho would have been able to explain that. Dostoevsky was right. Nothing is harder to believe than reality. 2. The Lost Labyrinth. One must not mistake majority for truth. Jean Cocteau, French poet, 1889 to 1963. 10 years ago, I thought it would be pointless to write about Egypt. Indubitably, we know all there is to know, don't we? Rather reluctantly, I was leafing through books about Egypt. Pyramids and more pyramids. Sphinxes. Pharaohs. Strange gods with even stranger headdresses. Downright comical. Since my job entailed a lot of visits to museums all over the world, I kept running into these ancient Egyptians wherever I went. Gradually, I became familiar with the names of the various gods, and soon I greeted them like old friends whenever I saw them on their pedestals or in their glass cases at the museum. Hathor? Oh, she is the one who gracefully balances the horns of a cow and a sun disk on her hair. Thoth? I know. He's the strapping young man with the face of a bird and the half-moon and sphere over his head. He's an old colleague, by the way, because Thoth is the god of writers. Sobek? Isn't he the weird one with the crocodile's head that has antennas attached to it? Min? No mistaking him with that double row of sun batteries over his hood. Clearly, he needs energy. He's always shown with a three-tailed whip. Horus? My old buddy. No one visiting Egypt could possibly miss him. His tool, the winged sun disk, beckons from almost every gilded ceiling and dominates the monumental entrances to many temples. A very suitable logo for flying trains, magnetic trains, or UFOs. Add to that the eye of Horus, always watchful, always present above the earth, singularly suited to be the god of satellite builders. Horus himself is depicted in different ways in Upper versus Lower Egypt, either as a human with a falcon's head or as a full-fledged falcon. His double crown reminds me irreverently of a ladle with a liquor bottle in it. Oh well, we have to relate somehow to these ancient headdresses. There are myriads of gods, male and female. Some are human-animal hybrids, others plain animals. The heavenly world of the Egyptian gods is rather simple, until we start looking at the family ties between the different gods. Moreover, creative human storytelling is bound to exaggerate or distort the facts about these divine creatures. Why should Egypt be any different than ancient Greece, India, Japan, or Central America? Mankind needs a god for every little problem, as evidenced by the various Christian saints canonized in the last 2,000 years. At some point, I got hold of a book about the Egyptian gods. It was dry and monotonous reading. I remember how grudgingly I struggled through the book. I could not have cared less about which god fathered which divine offspring or which incest produced which godly brat. I figured I would be able to look up this information in any of a number of excellent encyclopedias about mythology if I should ever need it. Besides, archaeologists have done a marvelous job of listing all the names and reigns of all the pharaohs. They have labeled every temple and every statue, and have discussed every piece of artwork in great detail. It was very doubtful that I would ever write a book about Egypt. It was just not my cup of tea. I am a detective, an explorer in search of unsolved mysteries. What mysteries did Egypt have left that needed to be solved? From Saul to Paul. My attitude changed abruptly a few years ago when I was looking for some unrelated information in the works of Herodotus. By Jove! Herodotus was telling stories that did not coincide at all with the information promulgated by Egyptologists. Who was right, the historian of 2,500 years ago or the modern archaeologists? Was Herodotus an individualist given to exaggeration, or did other eyewitnesses from his era corroborate his accounts? The discrepancies between Herodotus and today's interpretation of events were often so blatant and shocking that I began to investigate. The further I plunged into the ancient literature, the more fascinating Egypt became. I was hooked. This could not be true. Had those Egyptologists whom I had praised so highly been asleep at the wheel? Were they satisfied with simply gluing the pieces of the puzzle back in place, superficially, without investigating the discrepancies underneath? Was I on the trail of some ancient knowledge that only the dignitaries of obscure secret organizations were privy to? Were there things to be learned about ancient Egypt that did not fit into our modern world, that were not opportune, that were better left unspoken, so that average people would not be scattered in panic like a flock of birds? 3,000 years ago, the Phoenician historian Sanchu Neothon, around 1250 BC, must have pondered the same question when he wrote that, "From early youth, we are accustomed to hearing falsified reports, and our minds have been saturated with prejudice for centuries, to the extent that we guard the fantastic lies like a treasure, so that in the end the truth becomes unbelievable and the lie appears to be true." The philosopher Cicero, 106 to 43 BC, declared Herodotus the father of history. Although he certainly was not the first historian, Herodotus has kept the title to this day. Who was Herodotus? What do we know about Herodotus? He was originally from Halicarnassus, a town in the southwest corner of Asia Minor. His father rebelled so vehemently against the tyrant ruler Lygdamus that the whole family was banished into exile. Things were no different then than they are today. From the island of Samos, Herodotus observed the political events of his world. It was not a quiet time. Greece was threatened by the powerful Persian Empire. Athens had initiated the first Attican naval alliance and was competing against its military rival, Sparta. Maybe the political dissension prompted young Herodotus to probe and investigate matters personally. He became the premier globe-trotting journalist of his time. He traveled all over Asia Minor, Italy, Sicily, southern Russia, Cyprus, Syria, and even as far as Babylonia, where he stayed for some time. When Herodotus entered Egypt in July 448 BC, it was no terra incognita, no unexplored territory. One of his countrymen, a natural philosopher named Hecataeus, around 550 to 480 BC, had already described the land on the Nile. Herodotus, however, did not accept his predecessor's judgment uncritically. On the contrary, He viewed the writings of Hecataeus with a certain prejudice and a strong distrust. Herodotus never acted exclusively as a historian. He scrupulously noted all that he was told about the history of a country, but he also described the geography and topography of the areas he visited. He was just as much geographer as he was historian. Herodotus was the first to express the notion that all history must be viewed in the context of its geographical location, and that every geographical area has its own history. At the time, Egypt had established strong commercial ties with Greece. The Persian king, Artaxerxes I, 465 to 424 BC, who ruled the land on the Nile, used to send Egyptian boys to Greece for language lessons. Conversely, Greek merchants and restaurant owners had businesses in Egypt. Herodotus, who spoke no Egyptian, had to rely on interpreters, but there was no shortage of those. His sources were priests of various ranks from the sacred temples in Memphis, Heliopolis, and Thebes, as well as librarians, some members of the king's court, and Egyptian noblemen who enjoyed conversing with the Greek visitor. Herodotus quickly perceived the distinction between popular traditions and the official history of Egypt contained in the papyri of libraries and temples. When one of the priests read to him the names of 331 pharaohs, Herodotus wrote them down exactly, but when someone told him a story about the cow of Menkaure, he dismissed it as idle talk. He scrupulously recorded the heroic deeds of ancient pharaohs, but he immediately became suspicious and skeptical when he heard folk tales such as the one claiming that 1,600 silver talents had been spent on radishes and onions during the construction of the pyramid. An astute listener, Herodotus did not just write down gullibly and in utter amazement whatever was brought to his ears. He often added his own acrid comments. He supplemented what he heard with his own reporting, carefully separating second-hand accounts from his own interpretations. The following is an eyewitness report drafted 2,500 years ago. Bigger than a pyramid? To bind themselves yet more closely together, it seemed good to the kings to leave a common monument. In pursuance of this resolution, they made the labyrinth, which lies a little above Lake Moeris, in the neighborhood of the place called the City of Crocodiles. I visited this place and found it to surpass description, for if all the walls and other great works of the Greeks could be put together in one, they would not equal, either for labor or expense, this labyrinth. And yet the Temple of Ephesus is a building worthy of note, and so is the Temple of Samos. The pyramids likewise surpass description, and are severely equal to a number of the greatest works of the Greeks. But the labyrinth surpasses the pyramids. It has 12 courts, all of them roofed, with gates exactly opposite one another, 6 looking to the north and 6 to the south. A single wall surrounds the entire building. There are 2 different sorts of chambers throughout, half underground, half above ground, the latter built upon the former. The whole number of these chambers is 3,000, 1,500 of each kind. The upper chambers I myself passed through and saw, and what I say concerning them is from my own observation. Of the underground chambers I can only speak from report, for the keepers of the building could not be got to show them, since they contained, as they said, the sepulchres of the kings who built the labyrinth and also the sacred crocodiles. Thus it is from hearsay only that I can speak of the lower chambers. The upper chambers, however, I saw with my own eyes, and found them to excel all other human productions. At the corner of the labyrinth stands a pyramid 40 fathoms high, with large figures engraved on it, which is entered by a subterranean passage. Wonderful as is the labyrinth, the work called the Lake of Moeris, which is close by the labyrinth, is yet more astonishing. It is manifestly an artificial excavation, for nearly in the center there stand 2 pyramids, rising to the height of 50 fathoms, above the surface of the water, and extending as far beneath. crowned each of them with a colossal statue sitting upon a throne. The Great Pyramid of Giza is arguably the most monumental building in Egyptian history, one of the seven wonders of the world. How can Herodotus, who knew this pyramid very well, describe a maze that is beyond words and even surpasses the Great Pyramid? Did the hot Egyptian sun bake his brain? Not likely. Considering the fact that Herodotus emphasizes four times in the preceding passage that he actually saw this labyrinth. I visited this place and found it to surpass description. The upper chambers I myself passed through and saw, and what I say concerning them is from my own observation. The upper chambers, however, I saw with my own eyes. And it is manifestly an artificial excavation. I am grateful for his distance, his clear distinction between the things he marvels at with his own eyes and the things he is told by others. Of the underground chambers I can only speak from report, and thus it is from hearsay only that I can speak of the lower chambers. If we are to believe Herodotus, the labyrinth must have been a fabulous construction achievement. Imagine 1,500 rooms above ground with covered yards and one wall surrounding the whole humongous complex. Gigantic. As if that were not enough, there is also a large artificial lake from which two pyramids protrude. I have to stretch my imagination to the limit to come up with even a faint idea of how such a gigantic building could have disappeared from the face of the earth without a trace. Clearly, it was there in the fall of 448 BC. It could be argued that later generations took the maze complex apart, piece by piece, to use as construction material for other buildings. But who could have done it? During the time of Herodotus and thereafter, Egypt did not produce another single outstanding edifice. The pyramid building era had long passed. The temples were crumbling. The Romans, Christians, and Arabs who succeeded the ancient Egyptians did not build anything out of the ordinary. Then again, does it have to have been something extraordinary? After all, the ancient towering monuments could have been dismantled and used piecemeal for building houses and roads. There are a number of proven incidents worldwide where this was the case. But where are those Egyptian stone houses erected with enormous blocks from the ancient labyrinth? Where are these extravagant highways paved with ornate stones with lavishly detailed engravings of the gods? Herodotus describes the interior of this miraculous building. A world of wonders. For the passages through the houses and the varied windings of the paths across the courts excited in me infinite admiration as I passed from the courts into chambers, and from the chambers into colonnades, and from colonnades into fresh houses, and again from these into courts unseen before. The roof was throughout of stone, like the walls, and the walls were carved all over with figures. Every court was surrounded with a colonnade which was built of white stones exquisitely fitted together. The Egyptians never used such luxurious artworks, walls, carved all over with figures, for building houses or streets. Even during the reign of the Ptolemies and the Romans, religious traditions were highly regarded. The Romans were no barbarians. Their historians would have recorded the pillaging and dismantling of such a unique and beautiful edifice. But the records make no mention of anything like that. Did Muslims dissemble the maze? Did they use the materials to build mosques or the huge citadel in Cairo? The center of modern-day Cairo developed from an army camp in the middle of the 7th century. None of the building blocks used were lavishly decorated or unusually large. When Sultan Saladin ordered the construction of the impressive citadel in 1176, no one even remembered the existence of a spectacular ancient labyrinth. There is more to consider than simply the dismantling of a unique monument, surpassing even the pyramids, according to Herodotus. Consider the transportation of these monumental granite blocks, marble columns, and colossal stone structures which Herodotus describes. Such extraordinary transportation exploits, with all the attending logistics problems, were realized during the early times and the pinnacle of the Pharaonic Empire, and never again after that. Was the maize swallowed by the desert sand? Possibly. The sand engulfed entire pyramids, and even the giant Sphinx of Giza. But where, for heaven's sake, are the 1,500 rooms below ground with the sepulchres of the 12 kings? I have often been accused of having a lively imagination. I can visualize a fairy tale palace from the Arabian Nights. What kind of superhuman effort was required to construct 1,500 chambers below the ground? The ancient tunnel builders had no dynamite or modern drilling equipment at their disposal. I would assume that the 1,500 underground rooms were luxuriously decorated and filled with reliefs and sculptures. After all, they housed the tombs of 12 kings. What would have been used to light so many subterranean chambers? What kind of ventilation system would have been required during construction? What kinds of pictures or writings adorned the walls? How deep were the sarcophaguses of the 12 kings? What messages from an ancient culture are waiting to be deciphered in these 1,500 rooms? Holy Osiris! Shouldn't every Egyptologist be drooling at the prospect of finding this labyrinth? Where else in the world are we likely to find something like this? Even in the 1,500 above-ground rooms, which Herodotus described are no longer in existence, we should be able to locate the ruins of the gigantic wall, the foundations for the large colonnades, and maybe the crossbeams over the massive gates. Logically, the underground vaults would be easy to find after that. Ever since I started to delve into Herodotus's historical account, I have been wondering why no archaeologist has taken steps to search for the sepulchres of the 12 kings. Why do they just shrug it off? How can they be so indifferent in the face of such a sensational prospect? A matter of faith? I know the reasons behind their indifferent and lazy attitude. Some archaeologists claim that Herodotus's account is not believable. The majority, however, are convinced that the maze has long been discovered. Much has been written about Herodotus's credibility, not just some articles in academic journals, but full-length books, thick and voluminous. I concede to every scholar studying Herodotus' genuine effort and integrity, but every evaluation of his works ultimately remains subjective in nature, since none of us knew him personally. We can draw but indirect conclusions about his character. Was he strong-willed? Temperamental? Easygoing? A quiet listener and note-taker? Among scholars, the father of history is interpreted as a studious collector of information, a pleasant storyteller, a semi-scientific amateur, or even a liar. He is praised for his extraordinary memory and criticized for arrogance. In 1926, the German philosopher Dr. Wilhelm Spiegelberg maintained that Herodotus reported the Egyptian legends the way he heard them, and that he can be completely trusted in this respect. O. R. Mayer Kimball, on the other hand, concluded in 1985 that the labyrinth Herodotus described is out of the question in the real world of Egyptian history. The geographer Hanno Beck is a bit more lenient in his assessment of Herodotus's work. He suggests that it was unavoidable that Herodotus misinterpreted some aspects, or that exaggerations or mistakes found their way into the Greek writer's works, because Herodotus did not know or speak the language of the people he was visiting. Nevertheless, Beck applauds him for his attempts to critique the information he received. Friedrich Ertel, finally, the author of a well-researched evaluation of Herodotus, concluded that nothing emerges from the historian's description of Lower Egypt that would impugn his credibility. On the contrary, Ertel maintains. In studying several rather profound works for and against Herodotus, I realized that the negative conclusions were always a reflection on the scholars who expressed them. They base their judgment on today's state of knowledge. Because this or that has not endured to the present day, because they cannot imagine this or that at the present time, they conclude that Herodotus must have been wrong. But how well does our present knowledge really hold up against 5,000 years of history? There is a Chinese saying, "All people are smart, some before, some after." Herodotus did not invent the maze and its adjacent artificial lake. Diodorus Siculus also described it in the 1st century BC. Eyewitness Report. After King Actinius died, the Egyptians regained the sovereignty for themselves and chose as king their countryman Mendes, who some also call Maurus. This king performed no marital deeds whatever, but he did build himself a place of burial known as the Labyrinth, a work remarkable not so much for its size as for its unrivaled cleverness of construction, for it is hard for anyone venturing inside to find his way out again, unless he has obtained a guide of fully proven experience. And some say also that Daedalus, who during a visit to Egypt had marveled at the ingenuity of the building, made for King Minos of Crete a labyrinth similar to the one in Egypt, and in which, say the myths, lived the so-called Minotaur. But the one in Crete has wholly disappeared, either because one of the rulers demolished it, or because time has destroyed the work, while the one in Egypt has been preserved in its entirety down until our lifetime. Diodorus also repeats Herodotus' story about the 12 kings and the sepulchre they shared. He confirms the fact that the maze is located at the place where the canal flows into Lake Moeris. Diodorus claims that the artwork is so superior that it cannot be surpassed. 423 years after Herodotus, another eyewitness visited the same spot. The Greek geographer Strabo, around 63 BC to AD 26, traveled extensively, and in 25 BC his journeys led him to Egypt. Strabo's historical accounts have been lost, but most of his 17-volume geography has survived. In his last volume, Strabo wrote, "Be this as it may, the lake of Moeris, on account of its size and its depth, is sufficient to bear the flood tides at the risings of the Nile. Locks have been placed at both mouths of the canal, by which the engineers regulate both the inflow and outflow of the water. In addition to the things mentioned, this nome has the labyrinth, which is a work comparable to the pyramids, and near it the tomb of the king who built the labyrinth. For this is the number of courts surrounded by colonnades, continuous with one another, all in a single row and along one wall. In front of the entrances are crypts, as it were, which are long and numerous and have winding passages communicating with one another, so that no stranger can find his way either into any court or out of it without a guide. But the marvelous thing is that the roof of each of the chambers consists of a single stone, and that the breadths of the crypts are likewise roofed with single slabs of surpassing size, with no intermixture anywhere of timber or of any other material. And, on ascending to the roof, which is at no great height, one can see a plain of stone consisting of stones of that great size, and their walls also are composed of stones that are no smaller in size. At the end of this building is the tomb, a quadrangular pyramid which has sides about 4 plethora in width and a height equal thereto. Imendes is the name of the man buried there. Sailing along shore for a distance of 100 stadia, one comes to the city of Arsinoe, which in earlier times was called Crocodilonpolis. Our host, one of the officials who was introducing us into the mysteries there, went with us to the lake. Like Herodotus, Strabo was deeply impressed by the size of the maze and its huge slabs of stone, but conspicuously, Strabo made no mention of the 1,500 chambers below the ground.